Yeah, I can introduce Steve right here. He needs no introduction, really. He's been around a while. You know, what cable do you sell again? What's the Com? Belden, excuse me. Steve's been with Belden 18 years, and he's currently the multimedia technology manager. You know, that and a buck and a half will get you a cup of coffee.
Among other things.
His latest book is the Audio-Video Cable Installer's Pocket Guide Handbook, and he says he's got one in his pocket. That's his.
Nope, not today.
Not today. I thought you had one. Okay, I'm wrong. That's his third book, and he's on his fourth book, and he's looking for a publisher. I don't know if any of your books are on the New York Times bestseller list.
Actually, I'm looking for an agent. I need an agent for the fourth book. If you know a literary agent, let me know.
And it's his article in Radio World that I love to read, Wired for Sound. So we've got to tell you a few things about Steve. He was born in Sydney, Australia, down under. And he ran audio on a Duke Ellington band, big band.
Isn't that amazing? That's how old I am. Okay, I'm back again. And since you were just talking about Fringe, I will now go beyond the Fringe, you say. You remember that show? Did you ever see Beyond the Fringe? That was a great comedy show back in the 60s. See, I'm ancient. That's the thing. Where'd the clicker go? Ah, see? I knew it was somewhere. Thank you. Okay. Now, some of you have come to our booth and even looked at some of this 10-gig cable that we've been playing with. And so you believe it actually exists, but why would you possibly want it? What's it for? You know, what's it even mean? What's 10 gig? You know, I mean, we all have a gig, right? But do you have 10 gigs? Probably not. So let me tell you just a little bit about what's happening with Belden. If you came to our booth, you'll suddenly realize that we are now acquiring companies right and left. Thank you for the money that allowed us to acquire these companies. And we now own things like Hirschmann Ethernet switches, Trapeze Wireless. We're into wireless. I mean, we have wireless, you know? I mean, you can't beat them, you join them, right? So that's what we've been doing. And the one thing we don't own yet that I keep working on is a real connector company for the broadcast side, something I'd love to have. We tried to buy Kings. We tried to buy Trompeter. We tried to buy Canary. We've tried to buy all these people. So I'll tell you, now this might sound like a joke, but this is not a joke. Who should we buy? You tell me. Now, here's my business card. I'm going to put them right out here behind the projector. Take my card if you didn't already get it. Send me an email. Tell me who we should buy. I'll send it to the guy who does our acquisitions. I know him personally. In fact, he asked me if I would like to go to China with him looking at some acquisitions over there that we're looking at. And I said, no, I have to go to Madison, Wisconsin. You're welcome. You're welcome. So I'm not in China today, although I could have been. And maybe I will later. I'm actually heading for England in a couple of weeks. So this is a fun job. And if they don't kill me on the road doing this, I will continue this as long as I can. Because what do? Nothing. You see, that's the thing. I just schmooze with people. I'm like the head schmoozer, it should say on my card. Okay? So we are growing by leaps and bounds, as you can imagine. And isn't that the button I'm supposed to push? Hello? I'm pushing buttons. Oh. No, it's on.
It is. Try it again.
Nothing. And for my next presentation. Okay, next slide. Here are two guys. These are two guys. Well, one of these guys you might know. The guy on the right, Bob Metcalf. You ever heard of this guy? This guy is a billionaire, of course. And the guy on the left you've never heard of, Norm Abramson. Now, these two guys did some interesting stuff. The guy on the left was hired in the late 60s, early 70s, by the Hawaiian state government to come out and to figure out how to put data between all the islands. Now, in those days, it was really difficult to do this underwater wire stuff, so he figured he would do this wirelessly by RF. He was an RF guy. And so he set up RF transmitting facilities and receiving facilities on all the different islands. And in order to do this, he started to think about how do you send data from place to place. This wasn't that long ago, you understand. This is, 45 years ago or something like that, 40 years ago. And he hit upon this one idea, an idea that we remember him for to this day, except, of course, you'd never heard of him. And that was the idea of packetizing data, to take the data and turn it into little words of so many bits, like 8 bits is the most common form, and to send these packets from place to place, because then you can combine packets, and if they hit each other, then you send them again, they're collisions. This was all his idea, to do packetized data. Now, of course, he was doing this on a budget, as you can imagine, building this network, which, by the way, was called AlohaNet. That was the name of it, of course, because this is Hawaii. And so, since he had no money at all, he decided the one thing he will do for his crew to install this is hire a bunch of college kids, because they're cheap, right? And so he kind of advertised quietly throughout the U.S. for college kids. And one of the college kids that answered him was Bob Metcalf, a little younger than his picture there. He was at MIT. He was a graduate student at MIT. And he thought, hey, I'll get a couple of bucks an hour and a free vacation in Hawaii. What's wrong with this? And so he went out and joined Mr. Abramson in his quest to wire up the Hawaiian Islands. Now, Mr. Metcalf, strangely enough, had just taken a class in the statistical analysis of signals. Statistical signals. And the whole point is, this dovetailed perfectly with what Mr. Abramson was doing, because, in fact, the problem with AlohaNet was that there were so many collisions between the data of all the different islands that he was getting an efficiency in his network of 17%. To say 83% of the time, this thing just didn't work because there were collisions all the time. Metcalf, because of the classes he just took, said, hey, I know how to arrange this so they don't collide, so they're statistically not colliding with each other. And by the time he left this project, he had it up to 83% efficiency. So in fact, this thing really worked, thanks to both these guys. Next slide. So Mr. Metcalf thought he would work on this, so he actually got a job out of MIT working for Xerox. Now, Xerox at the time had this idea that they were going to become one of the great computer giants of the world. This, of course, was a dream that was not to be, because they might have been great in the copier realm and some other businesses, but computer networking and computers was not supposed to be. But he went to work for them anyway. He was one of the first hires. And he said, I have this idea of ways to hook computers together. And because previously he'd been talking about Hawaiian Islands and, RF going through the ether, they used to think the stuff between planets was ether. There obviously must be something there to go through. And so he said, let's call this EtherNet, going through what's out there, net. And he and this other guy, David Boggs, were working in this lab in Xerox in California, just south of San Francisco. And they succeeded on May 23rd, 1973, in actually sending data. Now, this was all coax-based computer networking. No big deal. Computer has been around, coax has been around forever, since 1929, so no big problem there. Just a question of what you want to use. And, of course, those coaxes, we still make these coaxes. Thick net, thin net, arc net, cheap net, crap net. We make them all, okay? They're all still out there. And one of the most interesting things about Belden is the fact that why do we make these cables from 1970 for computer networks? Well, obviously, because there's some guy out there who's still using them. And the other reason is, of course, because all the other manufacturers who are smarter than we are have stopped making them. So we're like the only game in town. And so we make a lot of money because we're the only game in town. There's somebody out there still making buggy whips. You know this, right? I'm sure if you bought a buggy whip, you'd be impressed at the price. Have you bought a saddle recently? Oh my God, you can spend $20,000 on a saddle. Amazing, because there aren't very many people making them. Next slide. And of course, we have all these other kinds of things, like ARCNET was a coax form from IBM. Interesting that it was 93 ohms. How do we get to there? Well, because, you know, there's nothing like an accident here. These are all on purpose. They wanted a coax that would have the lowest capacitance possible, because you see, you're standing square waves, right? These are ones and zeros. This is data. And so they thought, well, the way you get really good square waves is you have low capacitance. I mean, you audio guys would understand this completely, right? Rise time, that's all. And so capacitance, low capacitance equals really good rise time. So you have a really high impedance, you get a really low capacitance. By the way, that's how it works, you know? If the capacitance goes, the impedance goes up, the capacitance goes down, or the other way around. Just look at the cables and you'll see how this works. So if you want super low capacitance, you're going to have a super high impedance. Well, if you're talking about data in the megahertz range of data, which is what they're talking about, you really don't care about frequencies that much. And attenuation, which is what you lose, there's no free lunch here. You lose in the attenuation, but you gain in low capacitance. And so for a while, and there's still ARCNET out there, we still sell ARCNET as well. And so coming into this, where all this coax was everywhere, IBM said, well, IBM had this kind of ivory tower called the Almaden Research Center. You can still visit it, it's still there, in San Jose, just south of San Francisco. This was like the beginning of Silicon Valley, quite literally. And in this ivory tower, all these brainiacs, you know, these guys who sat around doing nothing but thinking all day, which is a great job to have, because nobody can tell when you're not doing it, right? I mean, it just seems like you're always doing it. And the whole point is these guys said, well, wait a minute, wait. There's a difference between coax and twisted pairs. These have been around for a long time. And the main difference is this: with a twisted pair, you can run it differentially as a balanced line. Well, you audio guys know this too. And with a balanced line, you can do something coax will never do, which is you can reject noise. It will get rid of noise because you have, you know, differential circuits and all the common mode noise can be rejected by a transformer at the other end or at each end, or a circuit that pretends to be a transformer, you know, active balancing. And so they said, well, why can't we do that with data as well? It would be wonderful to get rid of all the noise that is picked up by the cables. And so they started to look into the idea of using twisted pairs to carry data, which a lot of people thought was crazy, but works just well, just very well. And they came out with IBM Type 1. And IBM Type 1 was the first twisted pair cable to carry data. However, it was also the perfect example of a cable designed by engineers who would never have to install any, because this stuff is huge, it's like a garden hose. Sure, it's 22 gauge, it's big wires, it's shielded, as you can imagine. And not only that, then they had IBM Type 1A, which extended the bandwidth. Type 1, by the way, goes to 16 megahertz. 16 megahertz! Oh my, no, that's like light, you know? I mean, nobody'd ever heard of twisted pairs. Twisted pairs, those are audio, aren't they? That's the telephone company, isn't it? And now you're saying 16 megahertz on a twisted pair. Astounding! Of course, then they had 1A, and 1A eventually went up to 400 megahertz. Now, the only reason it went to 400 megahertz was so that they could carry video on top of the data. So you could look at your computer at work and have a little video picture of something there. Oh, this was hot stuff, let me tell you. Video to the desktop. Nobody ever heard this before. And then type 2, I mean, there are variations on the same thing. All twisted pairs. But as I say, the size of a garden hose. So people installing them didn't like this. The last building that we installed, that we actually didn't do the installation, but we provided the cable for, that was all type 1 and type 2, was Sears Tower in Chicago. That kind of dates us right there, doesn't it? Since that has all been torn out, and it's all gone now into something else, but it was the last 1A installation that I'm aware of. And the whole point is, okay, so what they had done is proved that twisted pairs could carry data. Okay, everybody suddenly believed that because they were selling it by the billion feet. But now can we get down to something that you can actually install, that we could actually use like a normal human being instead of this garden hose? And so lots of people started to make cables with smaller gauges. Now below 22 is, you know, 24. And, 24 is an interesting gauge because that's the same gauge as the telephone company. That's their standard gauge. They did some 22 as well, but mostly it's 24. And so people started to look at this and say, wow, you mean like we're going to make souped-up telephone cable? And that's exactly what we're talking about. The problem is that every manufacturer who made this stuff was different. They could make a certain quality, and some were better than others, and some did some things better than other things. And it got to the point where it was almost impossible to tell which was which. Is this good? Is this bad? Will this work? Will this not? Who knows? And into this mix came Anixter, a distributor. Our largest distributor happens to be, but that's coincidental to the story. Anixter said, look, we have to take all these things, all these different kinds of cable, and tell what kind of performance to expect from each one. And so they invented something which they still have to this day called their levels program. Level 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this tells you something about the performance of the cable. And they set up a lab in Chicago, just outside of Chicago, and they would test everybody's cable that came in and said, that's a level 1, and that's a level 2, and that's a level 1, and a 3, and you get the idea. And suddenly, you could tell what the performance was going to be from the cable. And you know what to buy. Now, around this time, two other organizations, the EIA and the TIA, Electronic Industry Association and the Telecommunication Industry Association, got together, and they had the same idea. We need to standardize twisted pairs. Now, they couldn't use the levels because that was an Anixter thing. So they picked a different word to mean pretty much the same kind of thing, which is the word category, which you already know. Next slide. And here are the categories. Now, the thing is, some of these categories actually don't exist because they said, okay, let's say this. All the twisted pairs that are out there now, like the telephone stuff and things like that, we're going to call that category 1. That's a done deal. We're not going to deal with that. That's why I put it in quotes here. POTS, plain old telephone service, you know, that's what that means. All that stuff, whatever it is category 1. And they said, any cable that's intended to carry data, it might be as well as audio, but really a data cable, we're going to call that a category 2. Those kind of exist as well, you know, kind of amorphous, but they're there. The first cable that 568, this committee, actually worked on was category 3. Category 3 was the first category ever. And the interesting thing is, now category 3 still exists, and it was going to die, it was scheduled to die, as many of these categories do die, until a little company called the FCC came into play and said, look, we have decided that all of the telephone cables that are coming into the houses in the United States will now be category 3 or better. And the reason why they did this is because, of course, one of their great worries is emission of interference from stuff that's being put in. And gee, I remember going by computer centers in San Francisco when I was, 20 or something, and my radio would just go skiwampus as I'm going by this building because of the stuff coming out of the building. And this is what the FCC was concerned with, interference with what's out there. And so they said, if we put in category 3, this will reduce the emission because these cables are intended to be well-balanced, you know, kind of RF-resistant, shall we say, twisted pairs. Better twisted pairs than we've ever had before. And so because of this edict, which was, I'm trying to remember how many years ago it was now. Maybe 10 years ago. It was quite a while ago that they put this edict out, that Category 3 survived to this day because it's FCC's standard stuff. Then after that, we go to Category 4. 20 megahertz. Oh, I left off a story about Category 3. One of the most amazing stories. Because you see, in all these category cables, and I have a bunch here I'll be passing out, in all these category cables, of course, there are 4 pairs inside the cable. Now, how they got to 4 is another long story, but the point is, these all have 4 pairs. And because they don't want the 4 pairs to talk to each other, they have to be twisted differently. There are 4 twist ratios, or what we would call lay length, in each of these cables. So the 4 pairs don't talk to each other. Now the question is, how do you know what to twist the 4 pairs so they don't talk to each other? Well, the old way was you twist them and you measure them, and you twist them and you measure them, and you twist them and you measure them. And then after 6 months or a year of doing that kind of stuff, you look at the data and you pick the 4 best numbers that you could find. And that's what you made your cable with. But then along came AT&T. Ooh, the big gun. And they started to make this kind of cable too. And they said, well, we're not going to twist and measure how, you know, plebeian that is. So what did they do? They rented a Cray, a supercomputer. And they said to the Cray, okay, here are the 4 pairs. I need to go up to 16 megahertz, you know, which is, you know, the same bandwidth as IBM Type 1, same thing. And, you know, so I need 4 numbers. Mr. Cray, would you please tell me the 4 numbers? Well, this took 2 weeks on a Cray, at 24 hours a day. It cost them $10 million to generate 4 numbers. And they had those 4 numbers for Category 3. No sooner did we say Category 3 than suddenly we're saying, oh, how about Category 4? Or worse than that, Category 5, which is 100 megahertz instead of 16. And the proof is, and the truth is, that after they pass Category 3, and then we're going to be going even higher than that. I mean, I'm going to go to, you know, 10,000 base T in a second. There is no computer on Earth that could possibly generate these 4 numbers. So guess how we do them? We twist them, and we measure them, and we twist them, and we measure them, and we twist them, and we measure them. And when we're finally, you know, going nutsoid about this, then we stop and look at the 4 best numbers, and that's the 4 numbers we use. And everybody does it this way still. Now, if you could invent a computer program that would do otherwise, you would be very, very rich. So please, you know, program your laptop to generate 4 numbers. We would love it. Of course, it has to prove it. Now, one of the things I'll tell you along the way that you have to do is once you have twisted and measured and you're going to go back and use those 4 numbers again, your measurements better be right. If you measured casually as to what the twists were, then you have no idea what you did 6 months ago, and you don't know if the 4 numbers are good, and you put them in there and the cable is not so great, and you realize, gee, I didn't measure the pairs very well. Which is why one of the things I can't talk about is the fact that we have this magic machine, I call it the twistometer, right? That measures our lay length, our twist ratios, with unbelievable precision. This is so secret, I have never seen this machine. So maybe it doesn't exist, you know? Maybe it's all hype. On the other hand, our cables seem to work really well. So, and the interesting thing is, when we started in Category 4 and Category 5 and Category 6, that for a long time we used the same 4 numbers in all of these cables. So these numbers must have been really, really good because we used them over and over and over again. It wasn't until we got to Category 6A, which I'll be talking about, that we could no longer use the numbers. They just didn't work anymore because we hadn't measured them far enough. And this is not the end either. There's more stuff coming. Next slide. There's category 5E, and I could pass some of these around just so you can see them. I have a couple, 2, 3, 5Es. I'll just, here, you get to play with one, and you can play with another and pass these around. And you've probably all seen this. If you've done anything with data cable, you've probably done stuff with 5E. It's, you know, a pretty common standard round cable, standard kind of size. Next slide. Here are three versions of category 6. Now, category 5E was 100 megahertz. Category 6 is 250 megahertz, 2.5 times the bandwidth. And therefore, first of all, there's some things that are problems with category 6 that really weren't a problem with 5E. One of them is the fact that simply twisting the pairs to be different than each other is not enough to get the crosstalk to a reasonable level anymore. So how do you do it? How do you get the crosstalk down? Well, there are two ways, two simple ways. The one on the left, the original category 6, which we still make, something called media twist, I've talked about this 1,000 times in this forum, is flat. And what we have done is moved the pairs apart. They each have their own little channel. And that's enough of a space. If you know anything about the inverse square law, it says you double the distance, you get 1/4 of the effect. So just moving the pairs apart, just this little amount, is enough that this cable started as 5, then it was 5E, and now it's category 6. Now, it won't go past category 6. It won't be 6A, sorry to tell you, because there are other things that come into play. But this is a cable that's lasted a long time. 1995, still going strong as category 6. The other way to do it is to put something in between the pairs. Now, in the middle is one of our marginal Cat 6s, which lots of people make this kind of thing. And you notice you can barely see in between those four pairs is like a piece of plastic. It's not even a wire. It's just a piece of plastic. And it's just enough to push the pairs apart so they don't talk to each other as much as they were, and everything's cool. Then you have real Cat 6 on the far right that has a divider in there with four little compartments, you know, an X or a T or whatever you want to call it, and each of the pairs is in its own little place. That's definitely enough to keep it so they won't talk to each other. Although I'll tell you, you know, even this kind of basic simple thing is very easy to improve if you think about it. You know, thinking is one of those, you know, brainiac kinds of things. And for instance, one of the things you can do when you think about it, instead of just making an X, you look at the pairs and you figure out which ones are more likely to crosstalk with each other. And so you take two Ys, and you put those pairs farther apart than the other two pairs. How simple can this be? So it's not an X anymore, but it just takes exactly the same amount of plastic to make it. You know, no big deal. Next slide. But now we come to this. Category 6A, because of course, you know, this is 1,000 base T, you know, a gigabit is not enough. Why? Well, because it's never enough, right? It used to have, you know, the speed limit on the freeway used to be 30, their freeway on the highway was 35 miles an hour, and people thought, wow, that was blazingly fast, right? Now the minimum speed on the freeway is 35 in most places, sometimes it's 45. That's the minimum. And if you can't do 55 or 65 or 75, you must have a pretty lousy car. And if your car says guaranteed to do 65 on the freeway, that means you will be in the slow lane for the rest of your life, right? You'll never pass anything. You really want to do 80 and 90. Of course, we don't talk about it, but you do, right? That's what you want. Because you want to be able to pass that truck and that car and so on. And so the whole point is now we're into 10,000 base T, 10G base T, 10 gigahertz of bandwidth, 10 gigabits of data throughput. And the point is, now how do we do this? Well, first of all, I start with the same kind of thing. You see the four pairs, you see the divider in between them, but there's another added thing. Now, this is our original 10 gig. We no longer even make this anymore. This is ancient technology for us. But it's a really good way of seeing what we did. Because when they started to make these cables, or just taking regular Category 6 and putting them together and putting 10G base T data down them, they failed because of one interesting fact. Not because the four pairs were talking to each other, but because each cable was talking to the next cable, something called alien crosstalk. And so the whole point is, what they need to do is push the cables away from each other. And so that's what that blue wire, it's not even a wire, it's just a piece of plastic on the outside. You can see it through the jacket. You can see it through the jacket. I'll pass this original. This is the only original piece I have left, so please don't steal this. Won't do you any good. It's only 2 feet long, you know. I can give you lots of real 10 gig. I have lots of samples up here, so you're welcome to take one of these samples. We've been passing these out. Here's our latest version of 10 gig. Now, I'll pass around one that is has the stuff taken off, because what I want you to see is what we did inside, how clever this is. You know, there's a spacer in between the four pairs, there's a spacer outside of the four pairs, and somebody said, I don't know who it was, but somebody at Belden with a brain said, why don't we put those together? Why don't we make them as one thing? And that's exactly what we did here. This is our second generation of 10 gig. And what we've done is we have a spacer here that is not an X, but an H. And if you think about this for a while, when you look at it, I'll pass this around, you can actually see that there's a little channel for each of the four pairs. And then there are these wings that keep on going beyond the four pairs, so you can see them on the outside of the cable to push the other cables away so that the cables can't nest with each other, right? No spooning, as somebody says, right? And because of that, these will actually go 100 meters at 10 gigabits per second and work. Now, the interesting thing is 10 gigabits per second doesn't mean that we're actually running that kind of frequency. It's not one for one anymore. In fact, on these pairs, the minimum requirement for 10 gig is 500 megahertz per pair, double what it was on Cat 6. 500, you know, it was 250, now it's 500 megahertz per pair. When they first started to talk about building this cable, the calculations told them that they really needed to have a bandwidth of 625 megahertz per pair. So we went off and started to make 625 megahertz cable, and everybody freaked out and said, oh, we can't do that, and so they're making 500 megahertz cable, but we brought out 625 megahertz cable. And what this does is give you not only bandwidth, but gives you protection in terms of headroom of performance, because we're still unshielded twisted pairs. The other thing you'll hear is that the only way this will work is on shielded pairs. Now, I'll tell you, data people don't really know shielded pairs. Certainly in this country, that's kind of a new thing, because they've lived in an unshielded world for the last 40 years. But you audio guys know exactly what the problem with this would be, because if you have a shielded cable, then you have to connect both ends of the shields, and no, you can't do that. You have to cut one end, right, because you're going to have a ground loop. Data guys don't know what a ground loop is. They think it's a kid's game, right? They have no idea what that means. But they will if they use shielded cable and have to ground both ends. And I don't think I have the slide here, but I have a slide that shows you what happens when you... Now, as in audio, the ideal way, if you're going to cut one end, is to leave the source connected and cut the destination end. That's what you're supposed to do. And that works better than doing the other way around. If you leave the destination and cut the source, you have an RC filter, which is horrific, and you can really see the effect. But if you leave one end, the source end, and cut the destination end, that's better, except I have a slide which I could show you, but I don't think I put it in here, which says that at every wavelength of the shield of the cable, however long the shield disappears because it's resonant. You have an antenna working at high frequencies. And so it's resonant at that frequency and every harmonic of that frequency, depending on how long the cable is, meaning the shield disappears with a regular basis. And if there's nothing there to interfere with you, no big deal. But if there's a radio station or a radar or something on that particular frequency, guess what? No more shield. So maybe unshielded twisted pairs are the way to go. Hint, hint. Next slide. 500 megahertz per pair, but we went all the way and did 625 megahertz per pair. This is duplex mode, meaning all four pairs are transmitting and receiving simultaneously, which sounds amazing, except, of course, that's what your telephone's doing, right? You talk and listen on the same pair of wires. No big deal, except we're just talking about higher frequencies. That's all. 10 gigabit throughput. And what that means is, if I'm going to take 500 megahertz or 625 megahertz and turn that into 10 gigabits of data, there's a lot of number crunching that is going on. That's for sure. And in fact, if you know anything about how the data runs on this, you know, this is PAM filtering, phased amplitude modulation, is the system that's used here. In 1000 base T was PAM 16. This is PAM 32. Which essentially means you 8VSB guys will get this. You know, you have 8 levels. This is 32 levels. 32 levels for each bit, right? And so you imagine what a little noise or a little interference will do. It will obliterate some of those levels, and you can't read the data at the other end. So that's why you really need a strong, clean signal out the other end. Next slide. Okay, so everything is critical. Cable. Connectors, patch cords, patch panels, bulkheads, feed-throughs, adapters, you tell me. Whatever's in the path is critical. Now, does this sound familiar? Have I said this before? Wow, that sounds like my HD speech, right? You know, BNCs, patch panels, patch cords, they're all critical. Hello, high frequencies are high frequencies. The same stuff that is happening with your video signal is happening with your data signal. Same exact stuff. And the things that make this go wrong are the same things, like wire ties tied nicely and tightly. Oh, that will kill a data cable just as well as it will kill a high-definition or 1080p video cable. Absolutely. Every interaction. Next slide. Of course, pair-to-pair crosstalk. So we spread the pairs apart. We put a divider in between pairs. Alien crosstalk, I've talked about that. Oh, one of the things is people still insist on taking category 6 and using it for 10 gig, which is fine. It's actually part of the standard. There's only one minor problem. Here's some category 6 here. 55 meters. It won't go the full 100 meters. And the reason is because eventually you get to the point where the alien crosstalk is just too much. This also means one interesting thing, which I've mentioned with video cables, but now I'm saying it with data cables, which is... And I'm sorry to say this, because this will depress you greatly. The messier the install, the better it works. And that's because when you make them nice and neat and you tie them together and so on, then the interactions between cable are like preordained, right? You've put them together. If you can vary the cables and how they go through the trays, like we vary the pairs inside these cables, we make the pairs go around and around so they don't stay in one place. Therefore, you don't want the cables to stay in one place either. You want them to vary. So a messier install will work better than a neat install. I'm sorry to say this. But as I would say in the video realm, okay, here's the deal. How many people are going to actually see the installed cable versus how many people will see the picture on TV? In this case, I'd say how many people will see the cable versus how many people are going to use the data coming out either end, you know? And the answer is, oh, like 1 in 1 million or... In the case of broadcast stuff, maybe 1 in 1 billion. How many people actually look in the rack? Nobody, right? So in fact, you know, who wins? Either it works or it looks beautiful. Your choice, okay? That's the simple choice. Next slide. Ah, the jacks. You see, this is just cable. What about the other stuff? Well, we realized you can't just put a Cat 6 jack on here. If you put a Cat 6 jack, you have Cat 6 quality. And I've just thrown away, well, this is Cat 6 cable here. If I use 10 gig and I put a Cat 6 jack, that's not going to work. So what I did, next slide, this is our 10 gig jack. Now, another thing you audio guys would understand, look at the back of the jack on the right-hand side. You'll notice that the four pairs are all at right angles to each other. Now, you remember when you were told, you know, if you're running audio across a power cable, and you don't want the power to that 60 hertz to be picked up, what do? You put it at right angles. You know this. Well, look at all four pairs. They're all at right angles to each other to reduce the crosstalk. And that's the thing. You look at any of the jack, they're all in like a nice long line. You know, you're going to punch them down in the line, and you have this huge amount of crosstalk from one to the other. Because as soon as you untwist that pair even a little bit, it's going to radiate. It's going to pick up noise. You've changed the impedance of that pair. And see, now we're talking about, 600 megahertz. Imagine how much of a change it takes for that 600 megahertz to radiate. Hey, you look at it and it radiates, right? So you better keep it exactly as you can and as far away and at right angles as you possibly can. Now, the other thing is you look at the other slide on the left there, the front of the jack. And what you used to look inside a jack, an RJ45, what did you see? You saw 8 pins, right? 8 nice little shiny pins. But you look in there, what do you see? That's not pins. That's a printed circuit board. That's a flexible printed circuit board. And we've ground out the area between the traces on the circuit board. So it'll meet with an RJ45, but it's in fact not pins at all. And this actually allows us to do things. First of all, it allows us to keep the impedance very, very stable inside there, which of course, if it's not, it radiates, right? Same thing. And the other thing is, inside every jack, and this has been true since Category 5, there are components in the jack to help reduce the crosstalk. And the question is, well, back in Category 5, the components were in the back of a jack on a little circuit board. If you pulled a jack apart, you'd find this little board with stuff on it. The problem is the distance between the front of the jack and the back of the jack at 100 base T meant nothing. But now we're at 10,000 base T, right? And so that distance would be a killer for us. Well, the funny thing is now we have a printed circuit board, so what you can't tell is that these compensation components are on the circuit board on the other side. As though that signal is coming in from the plug, it goes right into the compensation. And so this maximizes the crosstalk protection, shall we say. Next slide. Now I will confuse you entirely. Because a couple of years ago, at NAB, a show that you well know, and most of you attend when you can afford it, which is not these days, there was an interesting exhibit by a company called Genom, out of Canada. Genom, they make chips, they're a chip manufacturer. And they usually make chips, running HD or 1080p or that kind of stuff. Good chips, great chips manufacturer. And they have a secret room, which they will take you into and show you stuff if you're invited, of course, because it's the room of stuff they're working on, saying, do you think we'd sell any of that? Do you think we'd sell any of that? Do you think we'd sell that? And it's very interesting because it's amazing what you can do with a chip. The question is, would they sell any? That's a good question. And one of the things they showed was 100 meters of this cable, 1694A, which you probably know very well, standard video cable, 75-ohm video cable, running 10 gigabit data. And you think about, well, why not? I mean, this cable's tested to 4.5 gigahertz. 4.5 gigahertz. This stuff is tested to 625 megahertz. I mean, this is even beginning to get close to that. 4.5 gigahertz on a single coax, running 10 gigabit data for 100 meters. No problem. One coax versus four pairs. Less stuff to put back together, less number crunching. Has anybody done this yet? No. Could they? Sure. And the thing is, you think about this for a while, it's like, wow, in my broadcast installation, I could use the same coax to do video, HD 1080p. I could use it to do audio and digital audio, AES 3ID, that's coax, and data. Whoa, one coax, same connector, same strip tool, same crimp tool, same, everything, and suddenly I'm running everything I could possibly want to run. Of course, this isn't available, right? But the chips are there. So if you want to start making data stuff on coax, which is retro, it's very retro, you see, because that's where we started on coax, thick net, thin net, Now we're CoolNet, you know, invent a name here. Put your name on it. We could do this, you know, just let me know. I'll put your slide in here. Next slide. Okay, here's, that's what I just said. Next. And then we have SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture and Television Engineers. Well, some of you are probably members. I am a member. And by the way, I've been a member of SPE since 1979. I joined AES in 1969. I'm older than I look. I joined SMPTE in 1989. You know, every decade I join somebody. Who's left? I don't know. I'll join something. But the whole point is, SMPTE put together a committee, DC-28. You can look this up. It's on their website. And they said to DC-28, very simple, we want to know what we need in the future for, you know, Hollywood video kind of stuff that's coming down the pike. Now, you all are aware, of course, that almost nobody's shooting in film anymore. I had a conversation about sprocket holes the other day. It was like old home week, you know? Remember those? And the whole point is everybody's shooting in video, and now we have, you know, Cine Alta cameras and the red, have you read that red camera? That's astounding. You can do 4K by 4K images for $17,000. Unbelievable what's coming down. There's probably nothing you won't be able to do. It'll be free, you know? As long as you buy the electricity, the thing is free, I guess. But the whole point is, so this is what SMPTE's looking at, and they're saying, well, then what do we need to carry all these signals to the future? And by the time DC-28 spent their 5 years, took them 5 years to complete this project, they came up with this pronouncement that what they need is a 10 gig pipe. 10 gigabits per second is the size of pipe they need. Now the point is, at that point, and for quite a while, you could do 10 gig on fiber. Sure, I'll sell you fiber. There's lots of fiber out there that'll do 10 gig. Easily done. Of course, the only problem is that at the end of the fibers, you have some box doing the conversion. The fiber's cheap. Heck, we have a fiber kit. You can put your own fiber together now for like nothing. It's easy. Anybody can do this. Single mode even. Stuff that used to be, you know, special classes and microscopes. Now you can do it yourself now. It's easy to do. The fiber's easy. The boxes, well, they're coming down, but they're still there. And so fiber, at least for some things, if you're going from here to the next town, the only way you're going to do that is fiber. If you're going from here to the next room, that's stupid. Just do it on copper. Plug, 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 bang, 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 you're done. No conversion. Away you go. So now I can give you 10 gig in two ways, copper and fiber. And the point is, you know, here are all the things, you know, there's a list there of stuff that they would want to do on 10 gig. Now, you think about this for a while. 10 gigabits per second. What can I do on 10 gig? I could do 6 HD bit streams. 1080i, 720p. I could put 6 on this. If this were 1080p, I could put 3 1080p's. And with both of those cases, I would have room to spare to give you a network as big as you're already using for everything else that goes with it. You know, you've got PSIP or metadata, or you tell me what crap you got going with it. I have enough room to put that on as well, to go with all that stuff. There's only one problem, of course, and that is that I have yet to see a box that converts HD or 1080p or anything else to Ethernet, which is what this is. Now, would you please go and make a box, please, that goes from HD, 1080i, 720p, 1080p, you tell me, whatever it is, to Ethernet, because I have this giant 50-lane highway ready to take your trucks, whatever you're ready to go. Oh, and there's one other thing also. This is not the end. This is merely the beginning. They're working on the next cable, 40 gig. I kid you not. And you're saying, well, that's not possible. Oh, yeah? They're also starting the committee for the next cable, 100 gig. Now, how in the world do you do that? I don't have a clue. Don't ask me. I'm just a sales guy, right? I'll explain it to you when it gets here because somebody will explain it to me. I'm sure the number crunching will be very interesting. Maybe have, you know, superconductors in it or something by that point. I have no idea. That's a joke. Next slide. And that's the point. There are all these people out there doing networked video. I mean, this is a short list, and I'm sure you could add lots more onto this. You know, this is networked video. Next slide. You know, this is all 1000 base T. Gigi routers, no big deal. In fact, these are very common now, especially in factories where they have high-resolution cameras looking at ICs going by or oranges or whatever you're taking pictures of, right? So they need high resolution and, you know, that kind of stuff. Easily done. I mean, these are cheap cameras doing Gigi. Next slide. Digital audio, give me a break. I mean, on 100 base T, I can do 32 channels easily. On 1000 base T, I can do 320 channels. That means on this, I could do 3,200 channels of 48 kilohertz audio. 3,200, who wants 3,000 channels of audio? Do you have a need for 3,000? I don't know. No, you don't, okay? So the point is, audio is essentially a non-issue because it takes up so little room. I mean, you could do it in the corner of this one with all those HD images going by. You could do, you know, 5.1 channels of sound and not even notice it's on here. That's how big it is. Oh, and now up here I say, you know, here are all these quotes like, you know, Bill Gates supposedly said, but it's never been proved, 640K is enough memory for anyone, and, you know, there's a world market for maybe 5 computers. That was Tom Watson, the guy who started IBM, said this before his son took over. And the speed limit, of course, was 35 miles per hour for a long time. Next slide. Here's people doing networked audio. You notice these are all 100 base T? Every single one of these is 100 base T with various numbers of channels. And maybe some of these you know, like Axia. You know, Axia has over 1,000 radio stations now running Ethernet, multi-channel audio Ethernet. And they allow you to do, you know, redundant rings in case you're scared that this was going to go down, which is what people are scared of, you know. So they don't go down. Although I will tell you this, the worst data installations I have ever seen in my life were in radio stations. Oh, yeah, because the radio guy said, hey, we don't have to hire some IT guy. We'll just do it ourselves. You know, get these plugs, you push them in, yam, blam, blam, blam. Away you go. Well, because it's 100 base T, it's pretty forgiving, and the stuff actually works. And this, I saw 2 in one day in a major, major market. Shall I say the number one market in the nation? 2 stations? All working fine, but oh boy, I tell you, if I were a data guy, I would have freaked out. And the problem is this. They didn't know data. They knew audio, they knew video, they knew other stuff, but they didn't know data. So go take a class in data. Get, you know, Ethernet for dummies. You know, get something, learn something. You want to be unfireable? Be the guy who knows everything about everything, right? Because guess what? This is what's happening. It's all coming together. So be that come together guy. Be that convergence guy, the king of convergence. You need to be able to speak both languages. Next slide. Gigi audio. Next slide. Ah, my last slide. So what's going to happen? Now, here's my prediction for the future. Be prepared. You need to work on your resume with this. Because what's going to happen, of course, is that eventually there won't be memory anywhere. There will be massive, giant memories somewhere, and all you need is access to the memory. Do you care where it is? No, as long as your stuff goes in and you get it back when you want it. Nobody cares where it is. So your camera or your laptop or anything, all you need is access. That's all you need is access to get into the network. And then where will we put these? Well, I have 3 places I would put a giant server. I call it a yottabyte server. That's a trillion, trillion bytes, you know, 150,000 terabytes for everybody on Earth. And since your grandma doesn't need that many, you can take some of hers, right? Because she doesn't need them all. She's only doing photographs, right? So the whole point is this. The first place, Antarctica. Because this is going to be warm, right? So that's nice and cold. You put it down where it's nice and cold. It's huge. There's nobody there. And so the point is, if you can do ice climbing and computer programming, this is the skill set required to get a job on that giant supercomputer. The second place is in Siberia, because it's also nice and cold, and there are already lots of computer guys there from the gulag, right? So they can work on they're right there. And since the third one has to be somewhere that can see both of those other two, because, of course, they're continually writing to each other. That's how a RAID array works, right? It's continually writing its data so you never lose anything. Well, the third one, then, has to be in outer space, on one of the Lagrange points, you know, that's over the 22,500 miles up, where it's looking at the other two points and continually writing to each other. So I have a feeling if you're a really bad engineer, and I mean that in a legal sense, that they will assign you to the Lagrange point for a few years. That will be your punishment to work on the giant computer up in space. So that's my prediction. If you think something else or different, let me know. I would love to hear it. Next slide? I think there isn't a next slide. Yeah. You have lasted through another Steve Lampin presentation, which is amazing in and of itself. Do I have any questions? You believed it all. You're welcome to come up. We give you a sample, a little sample to take home. If you want a longer sample, give me a good reason. I could send you more than this. You just have to give me a good reason. You know?
We're about to do our data install, and it's going to be 8 billion feet of cable.
Oh, I'll be glad to send you some. You know.
Steve?
Yes.
The 10 gigabyte cable that you're talking about, I know from my background, there has been some talk about a potential Cat 7 cable.
Cat 7 actually exists.
It does exist. Okay. It's
very common in Europe. It's individually shielded pairs.
Right.
There's no connector that can go on the end because it's impossible to wire. It's only for punch downs. So it's kind of the trunk cable where you use regular category 6 or maybe our unshielded 10 gig as the drop cable going to each of those other places. But
I was wondering if this 10 gigabyte cable that you were showing is in that same category or classification as Cat 7?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And this is called Cat 6A, by the way, augmented category 6. Yes?
Still punching down the 568B and 568A standards?
B has one.
B has one?
This is all B. And in fact, in the case of this kind of stuff, all that magic happens in the jack or in the plug itself. Oh, by the way, that's one thing I didn't show you was a plug. I do have a plug somewhere, a patch cord that I could show you. Oh, here's the patch cord. And the cool thing about the patch cord, if you come up and look at the patch cord, is that the twisted pairs go right to the end of the plug before they end. In other words, they don't untwist anywhere. It's no longer 8 wires just hanging in space anymore. Those twists have to go literally to the end of the plug. That's the secret here. Yes. Next? No? Thank you for coming. Oh?
Thank you, Steve.